这个真是对你就是太刻薄的。我跟你就是刚懂了
，yes，
嗯 ，charity 什么意思
？yes，
这样放了更加。
I tried to gauge that. I mean, I've obviously seen gondolas before, but I also tried to use as a reference point, and I think I mentioned this in my supplementary statement, both the gondolas, both the existing Skyline gondola here and the Skyline gondola in Rotorua. I think they're reasonably apparent when you're very close up. And that's hardly surprising. And movement would exacerbate that. But they become much less obvious the moment you start to get out to any real distance, say much beyond a kilometre and a half, they start to become quite difficult to clearly see in their own right.
How far is
1.5 kilometers? Need to check something. It's roughly the distance between the upper between the upper terrace station and Lake Hazel Estate. From the terrace on Lake Hazel Estate.
So the carriage is going to be quite obvious anywhere on the cycle while you're down.
Yes.
But,
well, to a certain extent, except that once you go. Once you go further down, once you start to get down towards the deer farm, you're in a location where the whole system, the main system going up the mountain, becomes slightly more oblique. And I think the other thing that is quite apparent from looking at some of my early images, and by that I mean the ones from, I think if we go to an extra age, and around about photo location 6 onwards, say photo location 6 and then 9, and then you into the more distant views, but those two, 6 and 9, yes, you will see the proposed gondola system. But just to give you some idea, the only reason you can see where the existing power line is that tracks its way up those slopes is because of the area of cut up the slopes underneath the power line, not because of the power lines themselves. And so if you're looking at a series of pylons and lines and even the main body of the carriages, which are in a fairly recessive colour, you're still going to be struggling to see that sort of detail. Where it will be more obvious is if we go back further to my annexure's photo location 1, 2, and to a certain extent 3, and then again if we jump over to the lower shot over the river and we move on to, it's probably quite a long way up. No, I'll leave it at those ones for the moment. I'll have to go fishing to find the others, but certainly if you look across at photo locations 1 and 2,
yeah,
you'll certainly see the gondolas there.
I'm not sure that the skyline is an appropriate comparison, because you're looking straight on it there, it's almost two dimensions.
Yes, but that's going to be the case with views from Lake Hayes, for instance.
Up on the elevated part of it, but not yes. That far away.
You won't see much of the lower part because of the intervening poplars. Certainly while the poplars remain there. I mean, if the poplars for any reason go in the future, then yes, it would be more visible. But in terms of the current environment, no, you're not. And again, the best one to see that on is probably photo location 6. So you would get glimpses of it, of the system to the right in photo location 6, to the right of that main grouping of trees, or the lines of trees, and then you start to see them going up fairly just to the left of where that power line is,
yeah.
And going up the side of the Remarkables, up into that valley system, higher up. And the thing that I found quite noticeable was that if you look at those photos, but you also start to look at the view from photo location 9, 10 and onwards, is that the vegetation patterns across the landscape also tend to create a quite mottled sort of background. So it's not until the whole gondola system gets quite remote up around that noticeable bend of the Skifield Road and the upper station that it really sort of smooths out. The texture of the tussock field starts to become more homogeneous and smooth, and it's at that point you would expect to perhaps see more, but it's going to be so distant that I very much doubt if you'd see much at all. And I know that Ms. Melsop has raised concerns about the upper station. I actually have stated that I believe it needs to be assessed quite specifically because I do think it's a sensitive location. But I also think that you only have to look at the size of the... You only have to look at the patterning on the Northern Remarkables to realise it's not going to take very much to lose even a reasonably sizable structure in that sort of mottled texture and colouring.
It's quite prominent in location 11, isn't it?
The
station, the mid station.
Well, I don't actually think it will be.
Other than the fact that you seem to have a big cloud shadow just on the critical spot.
Well, that's a reality for Queenstown, I'm sure. No, look, I understand what you're saying, but I just think that by the time you get to that sort of viewing distance, you know, you're talking about the same sort of scale as rock outcrops.
Yes.
The only reason that the Skifield Road actually stands out is because of its linearity. If it was, in fact, instead... one confined area of earthworks or clearance, or one confined structure, I don't think you would notice it. But the fact that you've got this linear profile going across the main slopes of the Remarkables, that creates a different type of... It's clearly apparent on the face of the mountain range. But having said all of that, I still think it needs to be any development of the upper station needs to be subject to a fair degree of scrutiny.
Right. So to put you into something completely different, I mean your evidence in chief at 8.3.
Sorry,
8.3. And clause 4, management of building colour materiality and reflectivity.
Yes.
So you want management of all those things, except for the central village components of the IB3 development area. Why that exception?
Because I don't think you're going to escape the fact that that is a village cluster. It's a bit like saying Cadrone, and you know, you're going to try and disguise the fact that Cadrone's got a pub in it. I think to a certain degree there has to be an acceptance that this this development is where it is. But it's a case of ensuring that it sits comfortably in its setting rather than trying to completely camouflage or screen or otherwise hide it. And I think that if there's one part of this development proposal that probably needs less screening and camouflaging, as it were, then it's really that village core. I mean, you're also going to have a loading station for the gondola system. So you're going to have a reasonably sizable structure at that location anyway. And so it seems to me that, given that situation, this is one area that can accommodate some of that slightly more concentrated development.
Well, to me, that's not saying so much that it can accommodate, because it's just jolly well going to have to accommodate it because of the size of the buildings.
Well, they're not really excessive. I mean, I've indicated that I feel most of that development should remain at or below three stories. I don't think that that's exceptional. And I think, too, that one has to recognise that that's essentially concentrated on the lower terrace. It has less of a profile on development than development would on the upper terrace.
Is the proposal committed to that at the moment? Because I thought there were options there.
There are options in terms of...
For example, if you don't have the Lake Hayes station, it doesn't cross the river again there. What's that option? Wasn't the loading station going to be on the upper terrace?
It's if the turning station...
There were options. There were two options. One of them was
that's right.
Crossed the river again, and the other one didn't. And I thought if it didn't, it went straight to the upper terrace.
Well, it could go to the upper terrace. There would be an options plan provision if it didn't go to Lake Hayes. But you could equally, you could have it. There are two lines that have been shown.
Hang on. Where's the mock-up? It shows the other station.
Yeah.
The simulation shows.
So look at the
station.
Simulation of RB3.
Sorry, I just wanted to be clear before I started responding to that, because it has been an area of some complexity. The village, as it were, is still located on the lower terrace. The reason for that is that even though it's designed to help serve the gondola system, it also serves the connection, any connection across the river, So, for instance, the extension of the cycleway and walkway connections across the river via a bridge. It's also an area that is lower lying, so it's less sensitive than the upper terrace, so it's more able to withstand a degree of development without becoming too prominent. And it's also more directly accessible in terms of the existing road or track through the farm or station that would provide the basis for a new link road.
Okay. Now, because you've been a bit provocative further down, I'll turn it back on you. 9.2.
I didn't think I'd be provocative at all. Yes, I have got that.
So, the very real prospect of the village creating a field of dramatic, presumably drama, and counterpoint.
Yeah.
Yes. I can see what you're saying, but how did drama and counterpoint sit with section 16?
I think this goes back to the enhancement of the landscape experience in ways other than just conserving what exists. And I think that this is a subject that came up, I think, you questioned Mr. Young about this very topic earlier today. And I think that there are some positive benefits. I haven't tried to overstress them, but there are still some positive benefits associated with experiencing the landscape in a different fashion. And that idea of sort of drama would unfold as part of the experience of transitioning from travel through the river valley up onto the sides of the Northern Remarkables Range and then up to the ski field. And so I think there are some positive experiences that would be derived from having the gondola system.
Except that your sentence is actually about the village, not the gondola system.
Sorry, I might have the wrong one here.
9.2. Did I say 9.2?
No, this is
9.2. The very real prospect of the village creating a feeling of drama and counterpoint.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Well, I think if it's undertaken in a way that complements the Remarkables, which it should do, in my opinion, then yes, that can be achieved. But I also accept what you're saying about it in relation to Section 6B, which has a much narrower focus upon the protection of outstanding natural features and landscapes. So I suppose in common parlance we're sort of transitioning or covering that additional base of Section 7C and even the quality of the environment. And this is where, from my point of view, it gets quite difficult as a landscape architect, because we don't just compartmentalise landscapes into O&Ls and then forget about the landscape values that are derived from all other landscapes. In this case, I think there is the potential for there to be a positive outcome if the built form and the landscape design creates a village which complements its setting.
But isn't there a hierarchy in the area where you can't use Section 7 to trump Section 6?
But I'm not just addressing O&Ls at this point in my evidence. Section 9.2 isn't just about O&Ls and the protection of the Remarkables. It's dealing with landscape in a wider sense than that. In fact, that entire paragraph is really addressing the context for some views, not all.
Going back to the question I started with, we started here talking about context again, and then in the second half of it, you have a leap, a quite fundamental leap across the river. Which was the point I was trying to make.
No, I'm not, I don't actually, because that entire paragraph, in fact, deals with views from the Lake Hayes side of the river.
But yes, I does, but you have actually said that the crossing the river is something that's quite fundamental. Your words.
Yes, and I accept that. It is.
Characteristics and character of already modified parts of the remarkable ONL without eroding or appreciatingly degrading its core values. So, what are the core values of the remarkables?
I think the core values of the remarkables relate to the spectacle of its western face and to a degree its northwestern, I'm going to use the term corner. Its importance as part of a wider glaciated valley system. Its importance in terms of its relationship to Lake Wakatipu as a key framing element, along with the other mountains which enclose the lake. Its important sense of connection and linkage with the entire alpine chain which frames Queenstown and Arrowtown. Its sequence down to and relationship with the Kawara River. And then we get into a whole raft of more fine-grained elements. It's tussock fields, it's rock and scree and snow fields. It's clearly glaciated slopes and leading into areas of moraine. Its sense of being relatively, certainly in terms of the main western slopes, being relatively untrammeled by human development. And then as we move into the Kawara River Valley, its increasing sense of enclosure, the interplay of the sort of natural foundation and structure of the valley system, and some of its more cultural elements. And I think at the moment that's quite a sort of a reasonably harmonious relationship.
Just looking at the RR2, RR4, RR5 and RR6, is there anything that distinguishes what can happen there from what would happen in the rural residential zone in particular?
Well, I think there is now, certainly with the addition of the criteria that Mr. Sargent has added to Rule 27.5.7, I think that it's provided a much stronger focus upon integration of any development within those nodes with their landscape setting than you generally find in relation to the rural residential zone. But I think the other controls that also make a difference are the ones that Commissioner Crawford raised earlier, which is the maximum degree or maximum extent of development that can occur within those nodes. So you're sort of, right from the outset, confining the extent of development.
So are those additional criteria in 27.5.7, of course, those nodes couldn't absorb the development into the landscape?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. If that was the situation, I wouldn't be here. And it's the reason why I'm not supporting some other development proposals, which I'm not at liberty to discuss. But I think that, and I think that we're in a situation where the landscape has an ability to accommodate that development, to integrate it, but that it also needs some help if we're going to achieve a really high quality outcome that provides benefits rather than the sort of than the possibility that it will just see development dumped in these locations. There has to be an optimal level of integration, and I think that will be achieved through the additional controls that have been provided.
Can I just follow up on this?
Yes.
I wasn't clear what those criteria actually mean. I guess I should ask Mr. Sargent rather than you, but something like response of development pattern to landscape values both within the activity area and in the surrounding context, you've just given up the whole list of those values. So how would the planner who's evaluating the subdivision plan know how to fit those two things together, you know, the values driving it and
I've talked about those values that are quite high level. I think that I've also talked about issues related to the terraces, for example, the outwash areas, the riverbanks and so on. For me, those areas would be a real priority in terms of planting that integrates new development with its surroundings.
So could the criterion that actually said that be more useful? You can tell I'm not sure what response of
I think probably the second I think the second bullet point actually helps there. Planting and other landscape treatment that responds to the landscape values and rural character of the area. Now I must admit I have looking at this and you know, you can keep on refining these things till you're blue in the face. But perhaps rural character should be rural and or natural character. But it seems to me that the trouble is it's modified natural character too. It's not all endemic. So I think that from my perspective as a landscape architect, one of the first things I would be looking at is, well, okay, we're looking at locating, say, I don't know, I'm just picking a figure out of the air, 15 residential units in RR4. You've got a relatively flat, low-lying site that's already relatively enclosed. I'd be looking at how do you integrate that into its surrounds, You'd be looking at peripheral planting, you'd be looking at planting along the riverbanks, you'd be looking at trying to accentuate the terracing that's already found there and the outwash that leads up into the Owens Creek, or the margins of it anyway, because if you put it right in the middle of the creek, you're in trouble. But, you know, there's a lot of... it's those natural patterns that you'd be trying to accentuate.
I think you have a vision of this, and I don't think it's been communicated in the evidence.
I think it's really difficult to do that. It's really hard to, without getting into the absolute specifics. And I tried to cover some of that when I talked about where I would locate a lot of the planting, for instance. And I did talk about the fact that I think the river, the terraces, for instance, the escarpment between the upper and lower terrace on RB3 need to be basically set aside.
That's a common custom here in this town, yeah. Isn't it? It's what you do. I mean, there must be a good reason for it.
Yeah. Well,
it works.
It's unstable. It's steep.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, when you look at it, as we did through from in relation to several photographs, that's the part that's more exposed. So you want to use that to actually frame the development which is going on to the flatter terraces. So that would be a really positive outcome.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Thank you.
What you've highlighted is that those are not matters of discretion.
No.
I'm not quite sure what they are.
Oh.
But that's not your problem, it's Mr. Sargent's problem. You're a landscape architect, not a fan.
We like to think it's all about but that it's helpful just at that point, it's helpful to hear those things for us to think about. Because the challenge is how, from a legal perspective at least, how far you go into the resources and applications or a planning framework that enables opportunities. And I totally understand the tension, but that's what we're happy to hear the thoughts on that.
Now that we're talking about some of those areas, if we go to your Annex G photo location 50.
Yes.
Just looking at the rule 4453.
G50. That's this one.
G52.
Yes,
correct. It's this one.
Photo location 50. Just looking at how many, you could actually get 74 rural residential properties in that photo, but you might be a bit less because you've got some on RR2.
Yes.
But if we said 60, would that introduce an element of domestication into that view?
I think it would depend very much upon how it's designed. And I think that you can avoid domestication by the way in which you configure that development, both in terms of whether you are dealing with individual properties, which might be appropriate in some locations, but not everywhere, the degree to which you cluster or group that development.
But they have to be 4,000 square metre minimum site size.
Yes.
You have one per side.
Yes.
So pretty hard to cluster on a 4,000 square metre site.
Yes.
For 6 metre setbacks.
That's true.
And what about the roading access? I mean, the road to the individual house there would be multiplied somewhat, presumably.
In reality, roading access to those areas isn't that difficult or particularly tortuous.
The question was more the visibility of the road.
You would see it.
Hmm.
And I do accept that this is the vantage point, this vantage point more than any other, in which you would see that particular grouping of development nodes. But you also have to remember that for the most part, these nodes are also screened by Malvern Hill from the rest of the public realm.
Well, I was just going to ask you about that. In your supplementary, you talked about the view from the Crown Lane Road.
Yes.
As you can imagine, I know that road reasonably well, and I don't need to study the road in front of me as I'm driving down it, unless there's ice and snow on it. I'm a bit unsure how you can say that this area is not, there's only a glimpse.
Well, for most people, that's exactly what it would be.
But not for the driver, but not for the passengers.
Mm.
And the number of buses that they're looking for there every day is quite dramatic.
If we turn to that view, and you can see where RR6 and RR5 and RR2 are located on an extra 2, an extra 1 shows the broader view from the static lookout over the...
That's in the supplementary.
Point that I would make is that there's an awful lot to look at in this view, and this is from a static position. You go up over that little, it's not quite a stile, but it's a series of steps that go up over the fence line, and you can stop there and take a photo.
It's a popular viewing point.
It is, and you can see Chard Farm to the left. And if you go over to an extra 2, that gives you the relative location of RR6, RR5, and then RR2.
Well, and obvious questions with an extra 1 is why you use the 28mm lens?
Because that actually gives you some of the idea of the grandeur of that view.
Mm.
It doesn't just pick up what's directly in front of the windscreen. It picks up the much wider view than that, and in fact it extends quite a long way to the right as well. And if you look a bit further to the right, you're starting to get close to Corrie Peak and so on. So it's quite expansive. But what you start to realise is that Chard Farm is reasonably evident. But by the time you're getting back to the areas where RR6 and RR5 are located, and then RR2, you're looking at development that would have a pretty diminutive scale in real terms.
Well, isn't an extra 2 more like what you actually see?
No, I don't believe it is. And I think this is where it's really important not just to rely on photos, but to actually go to these viewpoints and actually have a look at them. But the human...
But I can say that you can scale it off how well you can see the airport runway, and an extra 2 is a better indication because you can see it quite clearly. And an extra 1, you can't see the airport.
Well, I can, but it's not clear.
No. That's what led me to the extra 2 being more like what you see out of the windscreen as you're riding down.
Mm.
There's several of the straights going downhill.
But the reason, Mr. Chairman, the reason I always remember quite a few years ago now, but working on a project that was near the treaty grounds at Taiti Bay, from near Pai here, and it was an appeal, and Judge Newhall sent the three landscape architects there out to have another look at the photos that had been taken, because it was dealing with a 15-storey apartment development that was proposed for Taiti Bay, and he said, well, He said, I'm not convinced that the photos actually capture, first of all, the full spectrum of views that's available from any of the viewpoints that you fellows have chosen. But secondly, that you realistically, in the simulations or montages, you're realistically portraying the scale of the proposed development. So what we soon discovered was that, in fact, the human eye, in terms of realistic proportion, is probably better. You're probably better using something like a 70 to 80 millimeter lens. But in terms of what the human eye sees at any one time, you know, you're out to the 155 degree mark, so you're out to 28 millimetres.
There's research about this.
There's lots of research, and in fact, it's part of the ESA ILA guidelines on simulation.
You're focusing on something, and it's a longer lens, but sort of audio video does somewhat equate to the 28 millimetre lens.
That's right, and so what happens is that the human eye tends to look at a scene, rove over it, and pick out points of interest, and then you focus in on them. Now, photographs can't replicate that. Right? It's just impossible.
So we'll stick with the site visit.
So I think the site visit is probably what you need.
Even just playing around on an early view on my computer, just if I magnify it, I've changed the focal length.
Yes, of course. That's exactly what happens.
And probably the difference I'm having is that I don't have a printed A3 copy I have on my iPad.
You can have mine. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, but you can have mine.
I won't. Yes, well, that's always an issue, isn't it, these aren't.
Right. And you can actually see the airport, but it's not, I agree with you, it's not terribly clear.
Mm.
And, you know, lighting conditions, the time of day, the weather conditions at the time photos are taken and so on, they can all affect.
Now, the other question I had in respect to that, if, as I understood your evidence, suggested that in seeing that view from the Crown Range Road, you actually saw a whole lot of other development in the view, and so this would not be exceptional. Was that misinterpreting?
No, I think misinterpreting. What I was basically saying was that you're looking at a landscape that's on a grand scale. And I think I expressed it before when I said, yes, you will be able to see some of the development which is occurring in those pockets, but within that grandly scaled valley system, the wider one that you see, it's going to be of such a diminutive scale that it's not going to be something that is going to change the character or values of that experience. Even more so as the vegetation around that development starts to mature. Now, I'm not saying that, again, I'm not saying that vegetation will hide everything because it won't and it shouldn't. But I'm saying it will help to bed it into that setting.
Okay. Any
questions?
So, can we just finish off talking about nighttime?
Yes.
What does nighttime matter? And what about with the skin? Because it would certainly look a lot different if it was printed away there in the valley bottom.
Nighttime, it's an interesting issue because I've had to confront that with, particularly with wind farms. And the reality is that at nighttime you don't see the landscape. What you see is a nightscape.
Yes, true.
And so you tend to be looking at something which is quite different. You tend to be aware of the night sky, and you're aware of this feeling of darkness and in some places remoteness, isolation, and so on. Those sort of qualities start to come to mind. The landscape doesn't really mean very much at night time, but these other things can. But in this particular case, you're also looking towards the fringes of Queenstown itself. You've got other, you're going to have the scattering of lights from farms, from chard farm, from from other developments. Now, that's not major, but it's there. So, yes, there will be a change, but I don't think it's going to be a major one. In fact, I think it will be quite slight.
And would you say the same about views from closer up? I know people won't probably be walking the trail at night.
No, I don't think the trail's the issue. Lake Hayes Estate is an issue. And I think there's no question that it would change the quality of that environment at night time, the outlook. But you have to still remember that above RV3 in particular, you're still going to have the dark mass once people stop coming down from the ski field. You're still going to have the dark mass of the Remarkables dominating the outlook.
It sparkles in the moonlight. I've been studying it. I've got a perfect view from shot over country of the road along the northern face. I can watch recessively coloured cars versus brightly coloured cars. I can tell you there's a difference.
There's a problem. And also because, you know, I mean, at this time of the year you've got snow, which has a reflective quality of its own. So yes, it will be different. Now, so yes, some people might feel that they're losing something, but you know, it's going to be people right on the lip of that escarpment at Lake Hayes Estate. It's not going to be most of the people in that enclave. And even then, you've still got the intervening poplars and willows and so on that are going to screen some of that. But I accept that there will be a change.
Does
that
in the gondola
feel
at what time of night?
Well, I don't fully. I understood that the gondola would only stay open as long as the ski field stays open.
Oh, and that money is not lit, is it?
That's as far as I'm aware. Yes.
I'm just thinking, going
back
to being away there as well.
Yeah. But that's really. That's probably got more to do with the capacity of the ski field and the number of people who want to use it, as opposed to the number of people who want to use the gondola. The gondola may well still continue after hours along the valley corridor, simply because it becomes another transit route, becomes another vehicle for people to get to and from the likes of Lake Hayes Estate.
What if they started doing night skiing at the ski field?
Then that would change, but that would be a function of the demand for the ski field rather than just for the gondola.
The implication being that the road would also be damaged.
That's right. You couldn't have the ski field operating without that. I mean, while the gondola may have a lot of appeal in terms for visitors and tourists, for a lot of people who use the ski field, who pack their families into it and so on, they'll still use the road.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. The same goes for the road into, you know, into the development, because once you've got two or three people, it's far more economical to use a car than to use a gondola.
It may be, but people may enjoy the experience too, and that's why I've stressed that I see it having a lot of appeal for visitors and tourists. But at certain times, it may also have appeal for people who commute, say from jobs near the airport in particular, to and from Lake Hayes and around it. And school children. Possibly. You've got the college, the secondary school, you've got sports facilities and so on. So.
Thank you,
Commissioners. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. I have Mr. Spear. Mr. Spear here. He's very well. Thank you. Just as a two-thirds of the school is certainly not at the scurrying close examination of the rules, just to see they've got a specific brief on going to construction and co-assist with the rules of other witnesses. We've got
section and reattach to the cable. Efforts were made to make these angle stations multi-purpose when feasible. Other important considerations for value are slope stability, and in parentheses, pylons and stations must be placed on solid ground, uphill carrying capacity, in parentheses, vertical rise in passengers per hour, carry determine horsepower and cable diameter, exposure to wind, parentheses, high crosswinds will trigger automatic slow indoor system stops, which are not desirable. Visual impact, parentheses, every effort is made to blend in and fit with the surroundings. Passenger evacuation, typically never an issue, but a feasible evacuation plan must be implemented and practiced yearly in the unlikely event that it is necessary. Construction accessibility, parentheses, LPUA installs cableways in the mountains. As a general practice, and although the RPL gondola is a challenge, we have had more difficult projects and have never failed. Ample ridership, parentheses, not an LPUA area of expertise, but projections by others, and our experience with tourism systems indicates that this gondola will be a success. And last, operation and maintenance costs, parentheses, a key element of the financial success of the system, and these costs have been calculated by LPUA and considered by RPL. 2.1, this has been an interesting, somewhat exhausting process. Well, not today, right?
In general.
Yeah.
Oh, you said
well, maybe. For instance, yes, this too. LPUA Engineering Department has spent more time on preliminary route design on this project than any project we have been involved in my time with the company. Given the large cost of band mid stations, it would seem to make the most sense to make a straight line, as straight line as possible, from the Remarkables Town Center to Remarkables Ski Area Base Lodge. Steep line options with one bend were researched by our lift engineers and by geologists. We found a route with solid ground that would deliver 1,000 passengers per hour in each direction, but we were reaching the limits of cableway technology. Focus began to move to a less exposed, wind and statics especially, line along the river and up Rastus Burn Valley. This was going well, but we still faced the cableway people per hour, passengers per hour, limits from the Queenstown Park Village Station to the Remarkable Ski Field. Once the decision was made to insert a mid-station on the slope, the carrying capacity limit was increased to 2,000 passengers per hour, and we had a system that would address increased demand. 3.2, passenger evacuation is less challenging with a new route because the line is less steep and road access is closer to the line in the mid stations. Not to be discounted is that although the final preferred alignment is longer than the initial options, it is separated into three independent lifts and it is inconceivable that any two sections would require evacuation at one time. Conclusion. Gondolas and trams for tourism and urban transport applications are becoming more and more common. In September 2016, we commissioned a five-section gondola system in Mexico City for workers, school children, shoppers, and tourists. It's been a huge hit. The President of Mexico attended the grand opening ceremony. We have installed seven gondola systems in Medellin, Colombia. We installed, operate, and maintain the Roosevelt Island train in New York City. This train is mostly utilized by workers and island residents transporting to and from Manhattan, but is used more and more by tourists. In my mind, the two largest advantages of the cableway application for urban and tourism are removing automobiles from the roads, three electric motors drive the entire RPL grounding system. And the small footprint actually used to transport so many people for such a long distance compared to roads and train tracks, for example.
The one question I had about the system was how do you get the electricity to the upper station?
The Remarkable Base Lodge?
Well, you've actually got two stations.
Two stations.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we'll have power there. There'll be a drive station up there.
Yes.
At the base lodge. And there'll be a drive station in the middle.
So you'll just be using the existing power line up to the Remarkable Ski Field, or will you have your own power system?
I believe we're contemplating that the transmission line in place will be improved, and there'll be enough power available for the ground line. That's an assumption.
Right. That's what I was wondering. So you're using the existing line.
Yeah, it's surprising.
Without possums closing it down.
Well, we hope not. But the existing power lines seems to me to be... It's marginal now, I think.
I think we've had three this ski season where it's closed.
Right. Now, so we will run on the grid normally, but we'll also have diesel engines. There'll be four systems. There'll be diesel engines that will run each section without any electric power from an outside source. Okay. And then that's what we call an auxiliary diesel. It'll run it at about 80% speed. Then we'll have an evacuation diesel that will run it. Let's suppose we lose the grid. Let's suppose one of the diesels overheats or blows a piston or whatever. Then we have another diesel engine, a small one, that'll evacuate the line so that we can run it at 1 or 2 meters a second to evacuate the line. Then we have a diesel generator on site, in case all of those fail, then we can run the lift at full speed.
One question. The restoration of what you just been said, noise. Have you done any sort of assistance? I mean, what's your experience with noise generated by the system?
We have done an assessment. As such, we built a gondola of similar horsepower at Vail about 3 years ago. It happened to be a 10-passenger gondola. And we took noise measurements at the drive system, at the top drive system. We measured from, I can't remember the distances, but from 100 meters to 50 meters to where the people disembark. And I can't remember exactly what the decibel levels were, but we can get them. Under diesel operation, it'll be loud, no doubt. But under electrical operation, it's relatively quiet. We use, obviously this is not the first gondola system where noise is an issue.
I'm just trying to find out whether noise is an issue.
Pardon me?
I'm just trying to find out whether noise would be an issue.
Where it would be?
Whether it would be.
I would think the less noise, the better.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So how much noise?
Well, I don't know the decibel level, okay? But what we do is we put, for instance, on the underfloor, we have two floors in the drive system upstairs. Right? We have the one floor you walk on, and we have about a quarter or half a meter to a meter distance from that to another floor that you would actually see, and that's about 50 mil thick wood. Tongue and groove wood that we put underneath the station to muffle the noise. And the windows are thick, they're insulated windows. We have insulation in the ceiling, all to muffle the noise. And so we take some steps to muffle it.
I have a
burning
question. To the
window system. not on the sides. On the ends, they'll open. We do that for ventilation when it's on warm days. They're hooked to a thermostat, and they open automatically. They can move out like that. But on the sides, they don't open.
On the ends, this is, I see the carriages.
No. You're talking about the cabins. I was talking about the stations.
In the
cabins, there's, on the up and downhill sides, there's windows up above that are about that high, okay, and there's two of them, and you can manually open them on both on the up and downhill side, so you can get air flowing through on one of them.
So that's in both the stations and the cabin?
Yes. There's also windows on the doors of the cabins that you, you manually, if you're uncomfortable, you can open them or close them.
We will do it until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Thanks.